Hey gang, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am JC Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. As you may be able to tell, I am a little under the weather today, so I'm going to keep this brief. But the show must go on, and we have a great chat with the one and only Tim O'Brien this week. Tim has a new record out on March 15th, simply titled The Tim O'Brien Band, and I encourage everyone to check it out. Before I get to our chat with Tim, I just have a few quick announcements. If you haven't been to thefretboardjournal.com lately, go check it out. We just posted the latest You Are My Sunshine project video from the incredible flat-picking guitarist Bob Minner. We also have some new videos and the latest The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons podcast. I think we are up to episode 6, and I can't tell you how much feedback I've gotten on that show. Folks are absolutely loving it. I have so many listeners writing in who say they don't even own an amplifier or an electric guitar, but they just love hearing Skip talk about the craft of electric guitar amp repair and how vacuum tubes work and all that other good stuff. So check that out. It's on iTunes and Spotify as well as on fretboardjournal.com. If you love what we are about, if you love the fact that we cover artists like Tim O'Brien and Bill Frisell and Blake Mills and Danny Barnes and all these eclectic artists that we feature every week on the podcast as well as in the print magazine of the Fretboard Journal, there are a couple ways you can help us out. First and foremost, just subscribe to the Fretboard Journal print magazine. It's really what we are all about. It's our flagship product. It's where we spend 90% of our energy and time. And you can do that at fretboardjournal.com. And if you use the coupon code PODCAST, you will save a few extra bucks. And I promise you will absolutely love it. If you are a true hardcore fan and love everything that we do, maybe you listen to all the podcasts we do, maybe you listen to or watch all the videos that we produce, and you just want to help us out in an even bigger way, we have a new program called the Fretboard Journal Insider. You can go to fretboardjournal.com/insider to join. And that is kind of a monthly recurring fee thing where if you've loved what we're about and just want to see us flourish, you can support us in a big way. And, in return, we are going to offer a ton of perks, exclusive, never before seen content from behind the scenes here at the Fretboard Journal, some print articles that have never seen the light of day on the World Wide Web, as well as invites to all of the video shoots we do here at the Fretboard Journal, and a lot more. So you can go to fretboardjournal.com/insider if you want to make sure that we are around for the long haul. It is a funny time in print publishing, as I'm sure you've noticed. I am a skier, as a few of you know, and my Instagram has been lit up all week long because Transworld Snowboarding, one of the original snowboarding magazines that had been around for like 30 years, just shuttered. And I don't want to ever shutter the Fretboard Journal. I want us to be immune to advertising trends and whether or not Barnes & Noble stay in business. And subscribing to the magazine, ordering direct from us, and also being a part of the Insider program and things like that really show your support for what we are all about and make us immune to all of the global trends, because I really don't want to have another day job. I want to just do this for another 15 years and beyond. So that is my soapbox. Here is my talk with Tim O'Brien. Again, the album is called Tim O'Brien Band. It's out on March 15th. Incredible album. Tim's playing guitar again. He's playing his 37 Martin 0018. We talk about that and a lot more. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. So let's get into it. I know you've been pretty busy, at least by Hot Rise standards, with that band. When did you find the time to carve out this new record?
Well, kind of always carving time out for various things. I have an ongoing solo career, so I kind of got this pretty good bluegrass group together and decided that we needed to record. We played some shows around the last release, and the missing element was Patrick Sauber, who signed on, and I had been playing with Noam Pakelny and different banjo players and just trying to work that out, but he's busy with a lot of stuff, and Patrick's of course very busy, but he's committed to this. And we had played some gigs and we decided to record. We started in October, I think. No, we started in April, and we did some more in October, when the next time we could get together, and then finished it all up, and it's ready to come out now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great record. I thoroughly enjoy it. Was the concept of the record, or sort of the material, did you guys kind of know what you're getting into going into it, or did it kind of evolve as you started?
It kind of evolved. I mean, I sort of wrote some more songs and got some ideas as in the months in between sessions. The one that Jan and I wrote, and the one that Dan Auerbach and I wrote, were later additions. And but you know, it's just it's kind of the same criteria that I've always used. There's sort of a certain amount of covers from earlier sources like Bill Brunsey and Norman Blake, and then there's traditional music, and then there's some of my own songs and some by friends.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of you know, broad as in the bluegrass spectrum. If you looked at this 20-30 years ago, you'd say this is fairly broad and fairly eclectic, and yet it's kind of what I've always drawn on.
Yeah.
And it's I don't know, it's kind of my view of bluegrass, I guess.
Yeah.
Remains to be.
Yeah. You mentioned you know, finding the banjo player, but on this record, am I correct in you're mostly doing guitar duties?
Yeah, I'm playing guitar. That's another thing that is different here. You know, I played a lot of guitar on my own solo records, but in general, there's another guitar player there on the live shows, and I just kind of want to be the main guitar player for a change, and it's been really fun to do that.
Yeah. When you're at home, what do you pick up?
I pick up the guitar, a mandolin, or a fiddle.
Okay.
You know, fiddle is kind of fun. You know, I play a lot of music on the fiddle that I don't play on stage, a lot of traditional old-time tunes and Irish tunes and that kind of thing. And, the guitar is the first, you know, that's my first musical instrument, really. I tried playing the piano first, but got into the guitar right away, and kind of all starts from there with, you know, the Beatles stuff and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Roger Miller, and stuff like that.
Was that in West Virginia?
Yeah.
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 And what was that first guitar of yours?
Well, I had a Silvertone, little Harmony Silvertone guitar. That was my very first guitar. And then I had a Sears. Oh, no, sorry, it was another Harmony solid body electric that I played in high school rock bands. And then my brother died in Vietnam, and he was in 68, and he was encouraging me all along to play music and to keep with the acoustic guitar. He left me $500 in his will, and wow. I got this Martin D28. I was 14, and I had a brand new Brazilian Rosewood Martin D28, and I really kind of, I don't know, that was a kind of a lethal combination, kept me in bluegrass, kept me glued to Doc Watson.
Yeah.
And that kind of music, and kind of wanting to do my brother's wishes justice in a way, to play acoustic music. He was a fan of jazz and R&B, but also said, you know, check out, because I think I sent him some tapes. I know I sent him some. We exchanged reel-to-reel tapes. We had a little Sony home tape recorder. And when I got my electric guitar, I plugged it right into that tape recorder, made some tapes just with a patch cord right into the tape recorder. And I thought that was cool. And I sent him some stuff. And he sent another tape back saying, that's great, but don't leave the acoustic one behind. He said, check out Segovia and Manitas de Plata, you know, the flamenco guitarists and other people. So, you know, kind of took it to heart.
Sent you on a journey. What, do you still have that, Martin?
No, I sold that one in probably 1985 or something. It had developed a few problems. Sold it to a friend. He sold it soon after. There was a crack in the neck along the line of the grain. It's kind of a weird thing.
Yeah.
I think it never really quite tuned up after that. But
Got it.
It was a great guitar. It was a great tool, and used it. I mean, I really used it a lot.
Yeah.
Now I've got an old '30s one, a 0018 that I rely on mostly.
Yeah, where did that one come from?
Well, I got it at George Grun's, I was looking at triple O's, and then there was somebody said, "Well, check out that old double there. You might find it more, not only more affordable, but just as good as those." And it was. It's a kind of a. It sounds really big for a small size guitar. Recorded on a lot of stuff, and people think it's a dreadnought.
Was that why you originally were going in there? Was for a dreadnought, or?
Yeah, well, I was looking for a triple O.
Okay,
but you know, looking at pre-war triple O's and pre-war double O's, there's a big difference in price.
Sure is.
You know, so actually, Norman Blake, you know, all these years later, he told me, "I think that this is the right size box for that scale length, the double O, as opposed to the triple O." When he made his custom model, he kind of made a deeper version of a triple O with that scale to see if that would work. And I think he liked it better. But I think there's something pretty hard to beat about the old pre-war triple double O's, rather.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And I know Martin made a batch of based on that guitar, right?
Yeah, they made a Tim O'Brien model, but they made a longer scale. It's kind of like a OM, but a slightly smaller bodied OM. And that's a good instrument too. I use that on the road a good bit.
Yeah.
The warmth of that old one though.
Yeah. Do you and Norman Blake talk often?
No, not often enough.
Yeah.
He's a real hero, and I try to visit when I can. It ends up being like maybe once every year and a half or something. And he's not on the circuit anymore like he used to be, and we used to cross paths quite often. Now he doesn't leave his home. And he doesn't want to sleep anywhere but his own bed, so he does a tour.
I can understand that. Yeah.
More power to him.
Yeah.
More power to him, yeah.
And we talked about your guitar. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk to you about the Nugget. I know we've covered that in the past in the Fretboard Journal, but is that on the record too?
Yeah, the Nugget gets played. The one I use in the studio and on stage is a Tim O'Brien model. It's a collaboration between Nugget and Collings mandolins. Nugget voices them and does the inlay, but Collings does sort of the production work beyond that. And it's a nice instrument. It's a little more modern than my old one. The old one was built in 76, I think. This one was built in 2003. And I just started playing it because it was new, and then I've really kind of warmed to it. I like it. I like it better than the old one as far as playability. It's got a radius fingerboard and stuff. And, it has a slightly narrower fingerboard. The one that I played all those years has got an abnormally wide fingerboard and a big beefy neck, which probably adds to the sound, that big neck. But this one's a little more manageable.
Yeah.
Playability.
For folks who don't know, Mike Kimnitzer, Nugget, you guys met in Colorado in what year? 76?
I think 74. I moved there in fall of 74, and I think Nugget had just moved there as well. He was working with Ohm Banjos, and he set up production for them to make mandolins at Ohm Banjos, but they never really did. They made a few prototypes, and I think a few mandolins were sold, but they never really pursued it. And so he went on his own. He had started on his own. He kept his own identity going, and it became Nugget Mandolins.
And
so the one that I got was kind of an early model. You know, it was the first A model that he made.
And was it the music scene or the mountains? What drove you to Colorado?
Well, the mountains, certainly. I spent a winter in Jackson Hole. I wanted to be out in the mountains and wanted to ski and stuff. And I was, you know, playing in bars and couldn't afford to ski much, but I did. But I did live there and learned how to play the fiddle that winter. I think kind of got to where I could play with other people anyway. Then I realized it wasn't, you know, the music was a little, the scene was a little sparse up there, and seasonal too. So I had some friends in Colorado. I went to visit them, and I got invited to be in three or four bands, and I went, well, maybe I should move there. So I moved there fall of 74, and started playing in bands. And, you know, I do like the West. I did like living in Colorado, and I ended up living there for 22 years.
Yeah.
And it was a good place, a college town, you know, it was a good place for music and a lot of people to collaborate with, and open-minded audiences and all that kind of stuff is all good. Colorado in general is that way. So it was a good place to start out, to find, you know, to learn the craft and just, you know, start doing my thing.
Yeah. Do you still ski?
Yeah. Well, I don't do it as much as I used to. And I'm lucky if I get 2 or 3 days a year. I'm going out to Colorado in March of this month, or actually, sorry, it's early next month, and there'll be snow, but I probably won't get on the slopes because I got to ramble from gig to gig. But I'll look at them coming by and I'll go, that looks nice.
Yeah. Like a surfer looking at waves.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
So when you met Mike in Colorado, was how important was, did you have a mandolin already, or was that kind of a new thing you were bringing on board? Yeah.
No, I didn't own one. And, my dad had given me an instrument that he had in college, which was a banjo mandolin. So I had a violin that my aunt had given me, and the guitar, and I had this banjo mandolin, and I started learning the fiddle after borrowing somebody's mandolin for a weekend and realizing, okay, if I play these tunes that I know on a guitar on a mandolin, it's fingered this way. So that was 72 and 73, and I learned a little bit on that banjo mandolin, but it wasn't a good thing to play on stage so much.
It's a polarizing instrument.
I mean, it was. Yeah, it's kind of a shocker, really. It's kind of unbelievably loud. But it was, you know, it would be good in a big jam session with an electric band, but just wasn't what you wanted for the sound. And so I think I had borrowed another A model, an old Gibson A model, from another friend, and then heard about Nugget, and he was mutual friends with some folks I knew in West Virginia. So they told me about him. I looked him up, and we got to be friends, and then he made this mandolin for me, which turned out to be a really good one for him as well as really good for me. It became a kind of a helped him make a reputation as a mandolin maker, because I was playing the thing all over the country, and it was a particularly good one. So that was an important thing to meet up with Nugget.
Yeah. Was it his idea or your idea to go with the A style?
It was my idea. He said that he had I said, well, you know, I'd like to get an F5, but I don't know if I can afford it. I said, what, have you ever made A models? And he said, yeah, I want to make some A models. Then he had a nice piece of top wood that he'd made another mandolin from. And he said, this is a good piece of wood, but I can't make a sunburst F5 out of it because it's got a black line running through the top. So I said, well, what about these old Gibson A models that were black tops? So that's kind of where we came up with that.
Nice.
Like the look of those. And so this is it's kind of happened that way.
It's great.
And it is a good top wood. I mean, it's really good Adirondack top wood.
You guys still talk?
Yeah. He's actually making now, I think he's making a 10-stringed mandolin he's never made. I showed him one that I got from Mike Seeger that was made by Vega. It's one of those old cylinder-back Vega mandolins, but it's a mandola, mandolin combined, and he's actually developing that plan to make one of those.
For
I'm
you.
I'm excited about that.
That is exciting.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope it's for me.
it's your idea.
Good, and I hope it's for me. You know, neither of us getting any younger, but I'm impressed that he wants to continue to come up with new things. He's really, he's just kind of a classic luthier, you know, one guy in a shop guy. And I'm really lucky that I got associated with him.
Yeah. I know I've talked to Nick and Hot Rise a bunch about his collection of instruments. Do you have a pretty big collection back at home, or do you keep it simple?
Well, I've got I've got a bunch of different mandolins, I guess, and bouzouki. I got a couple different bouzoukis, three maybe. I've got four bouzoukis. That's more than any man really needs. I'm looking for a good dreadnought guitar. I haven't had one in a while, and I've got a 48 D18. I want to turn around into something else. Have an eye on some ones made in the year of my birth in 1954. They're not the most coveted ones, and maybe that's better because I may be able to afford one, and also it might be less freak out to travel around on airplanes with it.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. I've got some, not like collecting like Nick does. Nick, I don't know what Nick is sort of, he's getting one of every good version of a certain kind of instrument, it seems.
Yeah.
But he's also kind of, now he's thinking about selling them off and, consolidating. And it's funny that I have never been the guy that bought and sold much. And mandolins have just been mostly used the same one over and over, and the same with the fiddle. And that's what I'm known to play. And then I've got this 37 0018 that seems to be the go-to. So I don't really collect them. I've got some other guitars and stuff, but that's kind of, those three are my things.
Are you drawn, when you're talking about maybe picking up a dreadnought, are you drawn at all to newer instruments, or are you always thinking vintage?
Well, I like the newer ones. I look at them and I got one of the, I got a torrified one, made by Gerald Hampton. He's famous for owning that lower prototype that Steve Gilchrist fixed up. But Gerald made this, 37 D18 copy with, it's all the same specs as an old D18, but it sounds really good, but it just doesn't get it louder. It hasn't developed. It sort of stayed the same. And I'm looking for one a little more open. So maybe I'm kind of hoping to be able to afford a vintage one, but I don't know if I'll, meanwhile, I see new ones that are really good. Like one of the best ones I looked at recently was a stock D18, just off the shelf at Grooms. So I don't know. I just keep looking. And meanwhile, I've got one that works for me. So I'll just keep on my eye out.
Yeah, well, you're in the right circuit. You're going to be exposed to all sorts of cool vintage instruments. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
What definitely. About the bazooka or the cittern? What who made that? Or the four of them you have?
The one the one I play the most is a bazooka made by Nugget Mandolins.
Okay,
and it's about a 24.5-inch scale, and it's made to look like a little sort of slightly shrunken L5. Sort of lower period L5, and it's great. I've been playing it with Jan. Two of us play around the house a lot, play Irish tunes and stuff, and probably going to bring it back out on the road for some stuff where she plays a mandolin and I'll play a big mandolin. So I play that one mostly. On the record, I played one built by Stephen Owsley Smith, and it's a 10-stringed cittern thing, and I've hardly ever used it, but I get it in and out of the case from time to time, and it's kind of a special case, that instrument. I tuned it into a root fifth, root fifth, root, kind of.
Okay.
10 strings and play in whatever key that is tuned to. So that song Wind on the record is played on that instrument. And that one, it's a real zingy kind of specialty instrument. It's kind of not as adaptable as some other things for me. I just really haven't understood the 10 string thing yet. I'm talking about them. Obviously I got a 10 string mandolin in the works. I need to study up on it, how to work them.
then you can record the video instruction course and turn others on.
Yeah. Right. Well, part of the beauty of these instruments is getting one like that, like Stephen Owsley Smith's instrument. I don't really know how it works, so really simple things become much more interesting again.
Mm-hmm.
Playing, just trying to make the right sound and make the right chord becomes, I don't know, within that struggle and sort of learning curve, some other things, interesting things will happen, like how to arrange a song or, how to you know, maybe find a new way into a song,
yeah,
a new song. And that same thing happens with a banjo, or just tuning my guitar different or whatever. Some piano or some instrument I don't know so well.
I can imagine. So the Stephen Owsley Smith, I think is what you said his name was.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you, did that instrument find you, or did you chase that down?
Well, I chased it down. He made some great bouzoukis for, people that I had met. And, he was one of the few makers in the United States that was making carved top bouzoukis. And, made one for a guy named Roger Landis, who plays a lot of Irish stuff. And he was from Kansas City and now living in New Mexico. But, I met him. That guy, Roger, put on a bouzouki festival. I think he still does a week of bouzouki instruction, kind of people get together once a year. And I went to that thing, and that's where I met Steve. And it's sort of, you know, it was an unusual thing. It's got sort of a Buddha hand on it, and kind of it's got a bunch of funny inlays on it. It's kind of another worldly thing.
Not the typical Nashville instrument, that's for sure.
No, it's not.
Speaking of which, how did you and Dan Auerbach connect?
Well, we met through David Ferguson, who's an engineer friend of mine and musician that I play with sometimes. He has a studio himself. That's where I made this record. But Dan moved to town, bought a building, set up a studio. Ferg kind of helped him set it up, I think. And Ferg's been working with him. So we got, you know, we got friendly. Just we meet at parties and stuff. Like, he came over once for a picking party and has brought his Uncle Jimmy, who plays bluegrass. And we hung out in the backyard and cooked food outside and played bluegrass. So I kind of got to know him through that. And then, you know, see him around town, and he's been writing songs with people. He's got this factory down there. It's basically his studio. People go, you know, you go write with him, and then he ends up producing a record with some of these people he writes with, and recording them right there.
It's like a Brill Building.
I wrote
thing?
One song. Well, it's like it's just like his studio, but it's like used to be that way with when I'd go write songs at 4Runner. That was Alan Reynolds' studio, and so he was producing Garth Brooks, and he was producing Kathy Mattea and Howcat Ketchum and people, and so you'd write a song there, and then it would sort of find its way naturally to the artist right there. You'd cut the demo in that studio, and then somebody else might come and recut it, or the demo might be a master. Like one of the songs that Dan and I wrote, he recorded the next week. He had some extra time when he had another artist in there. He recorded it, and he said, "Oh, can you come by?" I said, "I can't come by because I was on the road." So I came by to write songs the next week, and he said, "Why don't you sing a vocal part on this?" And he had cut it himself. So I don't know. Let's see if that works that way, like it did at Alan Reynolds's. Maybe he'll put that out.
That was a different song than Amazing Love, the one that's on the record?
Yeah.
Cool. So what does it mean when, because you kind of, I think, have co-writing credits on that one song. Did you come with most of the song? Did he bring something to the table? How does that work?
No, we just started from the ground up. We had no idea what we were going to do. We probably wrote a couple songs that day. I think we wrote two or three, but maybe finished that one and another one. It's funny. He was really good at pulling it out of you. I usually kind of labor over him for a couple of days anyway, a week or a month. No, he's really, and it's great because he doesn't have any preconception, and he just wants to keep it flowing. And whether you record the songs or whether they're, you know, you're at least doing something good by getting together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go by that too. Somebody like him, it's the percentages of success are higher though.
Yeah, why is that?
A lot higher. Well, he's got a proven record, I guess, that's part of it. But he's doing the thing. He's always doing it. He's always envisioning new songs and how they might sound recorded. So it's cool. He's kind of off the road and kind of liking to make these. He's got this label that he produces people and writing songs with friends around town. It's great.
Yeah. And what is where did you record the new record, the band record?
Recorded at Butcher Shop, which is Dave Ferguson's studio. He started that with John Prine.
Yeah.
Ferg's kind of moved away from being the engineer, and so Sean Sullivan has been his assistant and been the main engineer now for the last couple of years. He did the recording.
And you've always, I mean, all of your records, I've always sounded good, but do you kind of have the mic set up dialed in now for all these instruments you play, or do you mix stuff up still?
Well, you mix it up. I mean, usually you use some kind of, sometimes I'll stereo mic the instruments, but singing and playing them, I kind of got away from that, singing and playing at the same time, because it just kind of creates more phasing problems, questions. But this time, Sean used a dynamic mic, a Shure dynamic mic for the vocal, which kept some of that problem away. That was a new thing. And he still used a KM84 for the instrument. Mm-hmm. So that's usually what happens. I usually use a KM84 or something like that for the instrument. But whether you do it stereo or mono. And it's just, you know, it's nothing. I don't know. There's nothing mysterious about it. They're good instruments. Good mics. They don't really. Nothing's really changed since the 40s with the and 50s with these mics, and they haven't really been improved on. So you know, with digital recording becoming so much more common, the warmth of a tube mic became much more advantageous, much more, it lent more to it, to the digital thing, which started out a little bit brash and hyper clean and not as, I mean, the transformers were, the converters weren't as good. So they're sort of normal practice to use those for this kind of records, anymore. You know, there's new mics made that are approximating a lot of the same things, but it's hard to beat those old Neumanns.
Yeah, if you have them, use them.
Yeah.
So you guys are going to play this or play some of this material out as a band, right? You're doing some festivals and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're headed out actually this week or next week. We're starting our big run. We're starting in New Orleans, of all places. It's such a hotbed of bluegrass, but we're starting down there on the 15th. I'm really kind of just, I wanted to go play there, and I wanted to go to see the Mardi Gras Indians march.
Oh, yeah.
Which they do.
Good timing.
On the 17th. Yeah, they do that. They're going to march again tomorrow on Fat Tuesday, but the only other time they do it for sure is what they call Super Sunday, which is the Sunday closest to St. Joseph's Day, which happens to be the 17th of March, so I'm going to be down there for that. But anyway, after that, I'm going on a tour up through the Midwest. Let's see, we go to West Virginia, Kentucky, and then we go to Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and then to Colorado. So we got about 3 weeks going, starting on the 23rd. So that'll be a good little run.
Yeah. And when you're not on the road and when you're not with Hot Rise or doing, what's life like for you in Nashville? Are you still doing, do you do much session work, or is it mostly, you know, woodshedding and trying to work on your songs?
I'm just mostly, you know, I'm running a sort of a home business, you know, booking flights and motels and,
yep,
you know, paying bills on studio sessions, but you know, I do the odd session for folks. I can't remember I did something for Tricia Yearwood. I sang on one of her songs on a record coming out, and do stuff. I did a session for Dan Auerbach. It's mostly, you know, friends that want stuff. People send me stuff in the mail too, that you know, email me stuff to overdub on. I don't get too many of the sessions. Like, I'm not more of a specialty guy. I'm not like the first, I'll never be the first call fiddle player. And they're not calling a lot of mandolin players. So, I mostly do my own thing. And so the home business keeps me busy. I try to write some new songs and keep everybody, you know, I got to keep, to keep a band together, I got to keep some work coming in. So I work on that.
Yeah. Well, the output with this new record is fantastic. So congrats.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm.